to the north. The crone merely shook her head. That may be, but we have given our word, so to Ilwë we will go. Chapter 16. Darrow was waiting on horseback atop a hill when the army finally arrived at nightfall. A full day's march, the snow and wind whipping them for every damned mile. Adian, atop his own horse, broke from the column of soldiers aiming for the small camp and galloped across the ice-crusted snow to the ancient lord. He gestured with a gloved hand to the warriors behind him.
As requested, we've arrived.
Darrow barely glanced at Adian as he surveyed the soldiers making camp. Exhausting, brutal work after a long day, and a battle before that. But they'd sleep well tonight, and Adian would refuse to move them tomorrow. Perhaps the day after that, too.
How many lost?
Less than 500.
Good.
Adian bristled at the approval. It wasn't Darrow's own army. Wasn't even Adian's.
What did you want that warranted us to haul ass up here so quickly?
I wanted to discuss the battle with you.
Hear what you learned.
Adian gritted his teeth.
I'll write a report for you then.
He gathered the reins, readying to steer his horse back to the camp.
My men need shelter.
Darrow nodded firmly, as if unaware of the exhausting march he'd demanded.
At dawn, we meet. Send word to the other lords.
Send your own messenger.
Darrow cut him a steely look.
Tell the other lords.
He surveyed Adian from his mud-splattered boots to his unwashed hair.
And get some rest.
Adian didn't bother responding as he urged his horse into a gallop, the stallion charging through the snow without hesitation. A fine, proud beast that had served him well. Adian squinted at the wailing snow as it whipped his face. They needed to build shelter, and fast. At dawn, he'd go to Darrow's meeting, with the other lords, and Aelin in tow. A foot of snow fell overnight, blanketing the tents, smothering fires, and setting the soldiers sleeping shoulder to shoulder to conserve warmth. Lysandra had shivered in her tent, despite being curled into ghost leopard form by the brazier, and had awoken before dawn simply because sleeping had become futile, and because of the meeting that was moments away from taking place. She strode toward Darrow's large war tent, Ansel of Briarcliff at her side, the two of them bundled against the cold. Mercifully, the frigid morning kept any conversation between them to a minimum. No point in talking when the very air chilled your teeth to the point of aching. The silver-haired Fey Royals entered just before them, Prince Endymion giving Aelin, a bow of the head. His cousin's wife. That's what he believed her to be, in addition to being queen. Endymion had never scented Aelin, wouldn't know that the strange shifter's scent was all wrong. Thank the gods for that. The war tent was nearly full, lords and princes and commanders gathered around the center of the space, all studying the map of the continent hanging from one of the wall flaps. Pins jutted from its thick canvas to mark various armies. So many, too many, clustered in the south, blocking off aid from any allies beyond Morath's lines.
She returns at last,
a cold voice drawled. Lysandra summoned a lazy smirk and sauntered to the center of the room, Ansel lingering near the entrance. I heard I missed some fun yesterday. I figured I'd return before I lost the chance to kill some Vol grunts myself. A few chuckles at that. But Darrow didn't smile.
I don't recall you being invited to this meeting, Your Highness.
I invited her,
Adian said, stepping to the edge of the group.
Since she's technically fighting in the Bane, I made her my second in command,
and thus worthy of being here. Lysandra wondered if anyone else could see the hint of pain in Adian's face. pain and disgust at the imposter queen swaggering amongst them.
Sorry to disappoint, she crooned to Darrow. Darrow only turned back to the map as Ravi and Sol filtered in. Sol gave Aelin a respectful nod, and Ravi flashed her a grin. Aelin winked before facing the map.
After our rout of Morath yesterday under General Ash River's command, Darrow said, I believe we should position our troops on Theralis and ready Orinth's defenses for a siege.
The older lords, Sloane, Gunnar, and Ironwood, grunted with agreement. Adian shook his head, no doubt already anticipating this.
It announces to Erewhon that we're on the run and spreads us too far from any potential allies from the south.
In Orinth,
said Lord Gunnar, older and grayer than Darrow and twice as mean.
We have walls that can withstand catapults.
If they bring those witch towers, Ren Alsbrook cut in, then even Orinth's walls will crumble. We have yet to see evidence of those witch towers, Darrow countered, beyond the word of an enemy.
An enemy turned ally, Aelin, Lysandra, said. Darrow cut her a distasteful stare. Manon Blackbeak did not lie, nor were her 13 aligned with Morath when they fought alongside us. A nod from the Fey Royals, from Ansel.
Against Maeve, sneered Lord Sloane, a reed thin man with a hard face and a hooked nose. That battle was against Maeve, not Erewhon. Would they have done the same against their own kind? Witches are loyal unto death and craftier than foxes. Manon Blackbeak and her cabal might very well have played you for desperate fools and fed you the wrong information.
Manon Blackbeak turned on her own grandmother, the High Witch of the Blackbeak clan,
Adian said, his voice dropping to a dangerous growl.
I do not think the iron splinters we found in her gut were a lie.
Again, Lord Sloane said, these witches are crafty. They'll do anything.
The witch towers are real, Lysandra said, letting Aelin's cool, unfazed voice fill the tent. I'm not going to waste my breath proving their existence, nor will I risk Orinth to their power.
But you'd risk the border towns, Darrow challenged.
I plan to find a way to take out the towers before they can pass the foothills, she drawled. She prayed Adian had a plan.
With the fire that you've so magnificently displayed, Darrow said with equal smoothness.
Ansel of Briarcliff answered before Lysandra could come up with a suitably arrogant lie. Erewhon likes to play his little mind games to drum up fear. Let him wonder and worry why Aelin hasn't wielded hers yet. Contemplate if she's storing it up for something grand. A roguish wink at her. I do hope it will be horrific. Lysandra gave the queen a slash of a smile. Oh, it will be. She felt Adian stare. The well-hidden agony and worry. But the general said,
Eldris was to thin our numbers, make us doubt Morath's wisdom by sending his grunts here. He wants us to underestimate him. If we move to the border, we'll have the foothills to slow his advance. We know that terrain. He doesn't. We can wield it to our advantage.
And if he cuts through Oakwald?
Lord Gunnar pointed to the road past Endovir.
What then?
Ren Alsbrook replied this time.
Then we know that terrain as well. Oakwald has no love for Erewhon or his forces. Its allegiance is to Brannan and his heirs.
A glance at her, cold and yet warming, slightly. She offered the young lord a hint of a smile. Ren ignored it, facing the map again.
If we move to the border, Darrow said, we risk being wiped out, thus leaving Peranth, Orinth, and every town and city in this kingdom at Erewhon's mercy.
There are arguments to be made for both, Prince Endymion said, stepping forward. the oldest among them, though he looked not a day past 28. Your army remains too small to risk dividing in half. All must go, either south or back north.
I would vote for the south, said Princess Selene, Endymion's cousin,
Rowan's cousin. She'd been curious about Aelin, Lysandra could tell, but had stayed away, as if hesitant to forge a bond when war might destroy them all. Lysandra had wondered more than once what in the princess's long life had made her that way. Wary and solemn, yet not wholly aloof.
There are more routes for escape, if the need arises.
She pointed a tanned finger to the map, her braided silver hair shining amongst the folds of her heavy emerald cloak.
In Orinth, your backs will be against the mountains.
There are secret paths through the Staghorns, Lord Sloane said, utterly unruffled. Many of our people used them 10 years ago.
And so it went on, debating and arguing, voices rising and falling. Until Darrow called a vote, among the 6 lords of Terrasen only. The only official leaders of this army, apparently. 2 of them, Sol and Ren, voted for the border. 4 of them, Darrow, Sloane, Gunnar, and Ironwood, voted to move to Orinth. Darrow simply said, when silence had fallen,
Should our allies not wish to risk our plan, they may depart. We hold you to no oaths.
Lysandra almost started at that. Adian growled, even as worry flashed in his eyes. But Prince Galen, who had kept silent and watchful, a listener despite his frequent smiles and bold fighting on both sea and land, stepped forward, looked right at Aelin, his eyes, their eyes, glowing bright.
Poor allies we would indeed make, he said, his Wendlinian accent rich and rolling, if we abandoned our friends when their choices veered from ours. We promised our assistance in this war. Wendlin will not back from it.
Darrow tensed, not at the words, but at the fact that they were directed at her, at Aelin. Lysandra bowed her head, putting a hand on her heart. Prince Endymion lifted his chin.
I swore an oath to my cousin, your consort, he said,
and the other lords bristled. Since Aelin was not queen, Rowan's own title was still not recognized by them. Only the other lords, it seemed.
Since I doubt we will be welcome in Dorinel again, I would like to think that this may perhaps be our new home, should all go well.
Aelin would have agreed.
You are all welcome here, all of you, for as long as you like.
You are not authorized to make such invitations, Lord Gunnar snapped.
None of them bothered to answer. But Ilias of the Silent Assassins gave a solemn nod that voiced his agreement to stay. And Ansel of Briarcliff merely winked again at Aelin and said,
I came this far to help you beat that bastard into dust. I don't see why I'd go home now.
Lysandra didn't fake the gratitude that tightened her throat, as she bowed to the allies her queen had gathered. A tall, dark-haired young man entered the tent, his gray eyes darting around the gathered company. They widened when they beheld her.
Aelin.
Widened. Then glanced to Adian as if to confirm. He marked the golden hair, the Ash River eyes, and paled.
What is it, Nox?
Darrow growled. The messenger straightened and hurried to the lord's side, murmuring something in his ear.
Send him in, was Darrow's only answer.
Nox stalked out, graceful despite his height, and a shorter, pale-skinned man entered. Darrow extended a hand for the letter.
You had a message from Eldris?
Lysandra smelled the stranger the moment Adian did. A moment before the stranger smiled and said,
Erewhon sends his regards.
And unleashed a blast of black wind right at her. Chapter 17. Lysandra ducked, but not fast enough to avoid the lash of power that sliced down her arm. She hit the ground, rolling,
as she learned under Erebin's careful tutelage. But Adian was already in front of her, sword out, defending his queen. A flash of light and cold from Enda and Selene, and the Morath messenger was pinned to his knees, his dark power lashing against an invisible barrier of ice-kissed wind. Around the tent, all had fallen back, weapons glinting. Flanking the downed man, Ilias and Ansel had their swords already angled toward him, their defensive poses mirror images. Trained into their very bones by the same master, under the same blistering sun. Neither looked at the other, though. Ren, Sol, and Ravi had slipped into position at Lysandra's, at Aelin's side, their own blades primed to spill blood, a fledgling court closing ranks around its queen. Never mind that the older lords had stumbled behind the safety of the refreshment table, their weathered faces ashen. Only Galen Ashriver had taken up a place near the tent exit, no doubt to intercept their assailant should he try to flee. A bold move, and a fool's one considering what knelt in the center of the tent. "Did no one smell that he was a Volg demon?" Adian demanded, hauling Lysandra to her feet with her uninjured arm. But there was no collar on the stranger, no ring on his bare, pale hands. Lysandra's stomach churned as she clasped a hand to the throbbing gash on her upper arm. She knew what beat within the man's chest. A heart of iron and wordstone. The messenger laughed, hissing.
"Run to your castle. We're..."
He sniffed the air, looked right at Lysandra, at the blood leaking down her left arm, seeping into the ocean blue of Aelin's worn tunic. His dark eyes widened with surprise and delight, the word taking form on his lips.
"Shifter."
"Kill him," she ordered the silver-haired Fey royals, her heart thundering. No one dared tell her to burn him herself. Endymion raised a hand, and the Volg-possessed man began gasping, yet not before his eyes darkened wholly until no white shone. Not from the death sweeping over him, but as he seemed to convey a message down a long obsidian bond. The message that might doom them. Aelin Galathinius was not here. "Enough of this," Adian snarled, and fear, real fear, blanched his face, as he too realized what the messenger had just relayed to his master. The sword of Orinth flashed, black blood spraying, and the man's head tumbled to the rug-covered ground. In the silence, Lysandra panted, lifting her hand from her arm to survey the wound. The cut was not deep, but it would be tender for a few hours. Ansel of Briarcliff sheathed her wolf-headed sword and gripped Lysandra's shoulder, her red hair swaying as she assessed the injury, then the corpse. "Nasty little pricks, aren't they?" Aelin would have had some swaggering answer to set them all chuckling, but Lysandra couldn't find the words. She just nodded as the black stain inched over the tent floor. The Fey royals sniffed at the reek, grimacing. "Clean up this mess," Darrow ordered no one in particular, even as his hands shook slightly. By the tent flaps, Nox was gaping at the decapitated Volg. His gray eyes met hers, searching, and then lowered.
"He didn't have a ring,"
Nox murmured, snatching up a dangling edge of tablecloth from the untouched refreshment table. Adian wiped the sword of Orinth clean.
"He didn't need one."
Erewhon knew Aelin was not with them, that a shifter had taken her place. Adian stalked through the camp, Lysandra as Aelin at his heels.
"I know,"
he said over his shoulder, for once ignoring the warriors who saluted him. She kept following him anyway. "What should we do?" He didn't stop until he reached his own tent, the reek of that Volg messenger clinging in his nose, that whip of blackness spearing for Lysandra still burning behind his eyes, her cry of pain ringing in his ears. His temper roiled, howling for an outlet. She followed him into the tent. "What should we do?" she asked again.
How about we start with making sure there aren't any other messengers lurking in the camp?
He snarled, pacing.
The Fey Royals had already conveyed that order and were sending out their best scouts.
He knows,
she breathed. He whirled to face her, finding his cousin, finding Lysandra shaking. Not Aelin, though she'd been plenty convincing today. Better than usual.
He knows what I am.
Adian rubbed his face. He also seems to know we're going to Orinth. Wants us to do just that. She slumped onto his cot, as if her knees couldn't hold her upright. For a heartbeat, the urge to sit beside her, to pull her to him, was so strong he nearly yielded to it. The tang of her blood filled the space, along with the wild, many-faced scent of her. It dragged a sensual finger down his skin, wetting his rage into something so deadly he might have very well killed the next male who entered this tent.
Erewhon might hear the news and worry,
Adian said when he could think again.
He might wonder why she isn't here, and if she's about to do something that will hurt him, it could force him to show his hand.
Or to strike us now, with his full might, when he knows we're weakest.
We'll have to see.
Orinth will be a slaughterhouse,
she whispered, her shoulders curving beneath the weight. Not just of being a woman thrust into this conflict, but a woman playing another, who might be able to pretend, but only so far, who did not truly have the power to halt the hordes marching north. She'd been willing to shoulder that burden, though, for Aelin, for this kingdom. Even if she'd lied to him about it, she'd been willing to accept this weight. Adian slumped down beside her and stared blankly at the tent walls.
We're not going to Orinth.
Her head lifted, not just at the words, but at how close he sat.
Where are we going, then?
Adian surveyed his suit of armor, oiled and waiting on a dummy across the tent.
Sol and Ravi will take some of their men back to the coast to make sure that we don't encounter any more attacks from the sea. They'll rendezvous with what's left of the Wendlinian fleet, while Galen and his soldiers stay with us. We'll march as one army down to the border.
The other lords voted against it.
Indeed they had, the old fools. He'd danced with treason for the past decade, had made it an art form. Adian smiled slightly.
Leave that to me.
The Bane were loyal to none but Aelin Galathinius. So were the allies she'd gathered, and the forces of Ren Alsbrook and Ravi and Sol of Surya. And so, apparently, was Nox Owen. Yet it was Lysandra, not Adian, who made their flight possible. She'd been walking back to her own tent, to Aelin's tent, not fit for a queen, but an army captain, when Nox fell into step beside her, silent and graceful, well-trained, and likely more lethal than he appeared.
So Erewhon knows you're not Aelin?
She whipped her head to him.
What?
A quick, vague question to buy herself time. Had Adian risked telling him the truth? Nox gave her a half-smile.
I figured as much when I saw the surprise on that demon's face.
You must be mistaken.
Am I? Or do you not remember me at all?
She did her best to look down her nose at him, even as the messenger thief towered over her. Aelin had never mentioned a Nox Owen. Why should I remember one of Darrow's lackeys?
A decent attempt.
But Selena Sardothian looked a little more amused when she cut men into ribbons.
He knew who Aelin was, what she'd been. Lysandra said nothing and kept walking toward her tent. If she told Adian, how quickly could Nox be buried under frozen earth?
Your secret is safe,
Nox murmured.
Selena, Aelin, was a friend. Is still one, I'd hope.
How? She'd admit no more than that regarding her role in this.
We fought in the competition together at the Glass Castle.
He snorted.
I had no idea until today.
Gods, I was there for Minister Jovel as a spy for the rebels. It was my first time out of Perranth. My first time, and I wound up unwittingly training alongside my queen.
He laughed, low and amazed.
I'd been working with the rebels for years, even as a thief. They wanted me to be their inside eyes on the castle, the king's plans. I reported the strange goings-on until it became too dangerous. Until Aelin warned me to run. I listened and came back here. Jovel is dead. Fell in a skirmish with a band of rebels by the border this spring. Darrow plucked me up to be his own messenger and spy. So here I am.
A sidelong glance at her, awe still on his face.
I am at your disposal, even if you're not you.
He angled his head.
Who are you anyway?
Aelin. Nox smiled knowingly.
Fair enough.
Lysandra paused before the queen's too small tent, nestled between Adian's and Ren's own. What's the cost of your silence? Or does Darrow already know?
Why would I tell him? I serve Terrasen and the Galathinius family. I always have.
Some might say Darrow has a strong claim to the throne, given his relationship with Orlan.
I realized today that the assassin I came to call as a friend is actually the queen I believed dead.
I think the gods are pointing me in a certain direction.
Don't you?
She lingered between the tent flaps. Delicious warmth beckoned within. And if I were to tell you we needed your help tonight, and that the risk was being branded a traitor? Nox only sketched a bow.
Then I'd say, I owe my friend Selena a favor for her warning at the castle, plus saving my life before that.
She didn't know why she trusted him, but she'd developed an instinct for men that had always proved correct, even if she had been unable to act on it in the past, had only been able to brace herself for them.
But Nox Owen?
The kindness in his face was true.
His words were true.
Another ally Aelin had wrangled for them, this time unwittingly. She knew Adian would agree to the plan, even if he still hated her. So Lysandra leaned in, her voice dropping to a whisper.
Then listen carefully.
It was done quietly and without a trace. Every intricate element played out without issue, as if the gods themselves aided them. At dinner, Nox Owen laced the wine he'd personally served as a groveling apology for letting in the Volg soldier to Lords Darrow, Sloane, Gunnar, and Ironwood. Not to kill them, but to send them into a deep, dreamless sleep.
Even a roaring bear couldn't wake this lout,
Ansel of Briarcliff had sniffed when she'd stood over Lord Gunnar's cot, lifted his limp arm, and let it drop. The lord didn't stir, and Lysandra, wearing a field mouse's form and tucked into the shadows behind the queen, deemed it proof enough. The four lords' loyal bannermen also found themselves sleeping deeply that night, courtesy of the wine that Galen Ashriver, Ilias, Ren, and Ravi had made sure was handed out at their fires. And when they all awoke the next day, there was only whipping snow beyond their tents. The camp was gone. The army with it.
Chapter 18. No one in Aniel, or the gray-stoned keep looming over its southern edge, shouted with alarm at the rook that descended from the skies and alit upon the battlements. The keep sentries who'd been on watch had only drawn their weapons, one racing into the dim interior, and pointed them at Kaol and Irene as they slid off the mighty bird. The cold on the open ocean was nothing compared to the wind off the wall of mountains the city had been built against, or the blistering chill from the sprawling silver lake it curved around, so flat that it looked like a mighty mirror spread beneath the gray sky. Irene knew Aniel's layout was as familiar to Kaol as his own body, and knew, from the memories she'd seen in his soul and what he'd told her these months, that the gray shingles of the roofs had been hewn from the slate quarries just to the south. the timber of the houses taken from the tangle of oakwald lurking beyond the flat plain that bordered the southern side of the lake. A small offshoot of peaks jutted like an arm from the snaking body of the fangs, hemming in the city between it and the Silver Lake, and it was into the barren slopes that the keep had been built. Level after level, Westfall Keep rose from the plain to the higher reaches of the mountain behind it, the lowermost gate opening onto the flat expanse of snow, while other levels flowed into the city to its left. It had been built as a fortress, the countless levels, battlements, and gates all designed to outlast an enemy assault. The gray stones bore the scars of just how many it had witnessed and survived, none more so than the thick curtain wall that encompassed the keep. Intimidating, imposing, unforgiving. Kaol had told her the keep had never been built for beauty or pleasure. Indeed, no colorful banners flapped in the wind. No scent or spices drifted on it either. Just chill, thick dampness. From the lichen-encrusted upper towers, Irene knew that one could monitor any movements on the lake or the plain, in the city or the forest, even along the slopes of the fangs. How many hours had her husband spent on the tower walkways, gazing toward Rifthold, wishing he were anywhere but this cold, dark place? Kaol stayed close to Irene, his chin high, as he announced to the dozen guards aiming their swords at them that he was Lord Kaol Westfall, and he wished to see his father, immediately. She'd never heard him use that voice. A different sort of authority. A lord's voice. A lord. And she was a lady, she supposed. Even if flying had forced her to abandon her usual dress in favor of Rukan leathers. Even if she was certain her braided hair had been whipped in about a dozen directions and would take hours and a bath to detangle. They lingered on the battlements in silence. And Kaol's gloved hand slid into her own, the wind ruffling the fur along his heavy cloak collar. His face revealed nothing but grim determination, yet the hand he squeezed around her own. She knew what this homecoming meant. She'd never forget the memory she'd witnessed of the father who had thrown him down the stone steps a few levels below, granting Kaol the hidden scar just past his hairline. A child. He'd hurled a child down those stairs and forced him to make his way to Rifthold on foot. She doubted her second impression of her father-in-law would be any better. Certainly not as a gaunt-faced man appeared in a gray tunic and said, "Come this way." No title, no honorific, no welcome. Irene tightened her grip around Kaol's hand. They had come to warn the people of this city. Not the bastard who had left such brutal scars upon her husband's soul. Those people deserved the warning, the protection. Irene reminded herself of that fact as they entered the gloomy keep interior. The tall, narrow passageway wasn't much better than the exterior. Slender windows set high in the walls permitted little light, and ancient braziers cast flickering shadows on the stones. Threadbare tapestries hung intermittently. And no sounds, not music, not laughter, not conversation, greeted them. This drafty ancient house had been his home. Compared to the Coggins place, it was a hovel, not fit for rooks to roost. "My father," Kaol murmured so their escort wouldn't hear, no doubt reading the dismay on Irene's face. "Doesn't believe in wasting his coffers on improvements. If it hasn't collapsed, then it's not broken." Irene tried to smile at the attempt at humor, tried to do it for his sake, but her temper roiled with every step down the hall. Their silent escort at last paused before two towering oak doors, the wood as old and rotting as the keep itself, and knocked once. "Enter." Irene felt the tremor that went through Kaol at the cold, sly voice. The doors swung open to reveal a dark, column-lined hall speared with shafts of watery light. The only greeting they would get, it seemed, since the man seated at the head of the long wooden table, large enough to host 40 men, did not bother to rise. Each of their steps echoed through the hall, the roaring mammoth hearth to their left hardly taking the edge off the cold. A goblet of what seemed to be wine and the remains of the evening meal lay before the Lord of Aniel on the table. No sign of his wife or other son. But the face. It was Kaol's face in a few decades. Or it would be, if Kaol became as soulless and cold as the man before them. She didn't know how he did it, how Kaol managed to lower his head in a bow.
Father.
Kaol had never been ashamed of the keep until he'd walked through it with Irene. Had never realized how badly it needed repairs, how neglected it had been. The thought of her, so full of light and warmth, in this bleak place, made him want to run back to the rook waiting on the parapets and fly to the coast again. And now, at the sight of her before his father, who had not bothered to rise from his chair, whose half-eaten dinner lay discarded before him, Kaol found his temper in need of a short leash. His father's fur-lined cloak pooled around him. How many times had he seen him on this chair, at the head of this mighty table, which had once seated some of the finest lords and warriors in Otterlin? Now it lay empty, a husk of what might have been.
You walk,
his father said, scanning him from head to toe. His attention lingered on the hand Kaol still kept clasped around Irene's. Oh, he'd surely bring that up soon enough, when it would strike deepest.
Last I heard, you could not so much as wiggle your toe.
It is thanks to this woman,
Kaol said. Yet Irene stared at his father with a coldness Kaol had never glimpsed before, as if she were thinking of rotting his organs from the inside out. It warmed Kaol enough to say,
My wife, Lady Irene Towers Westfall.
A kernel of surprise lit his father's face, but swiftly vanished.
A healer, then,
he mused, surveying Irene with an intensity that made Kaol want to start shattering things.
Towers is not a noble house, I recognize.
The miserable bastard. Irene's chin lifted slightly. It may not be, milord, but its lineage is no less proud or worthy.
At least she speaks well,
his father said, sipping from his wine. Kaol clenched his free hand so hard his glove groaned.
Better than that other one, the swaggering assassin.
Irene knew. All of it. She knew every scrap of history. Knew whose note she carried in her locket. But it didn't ease the blow. Not as his father added,
Who, it turned out, is Queen of Terrison.
A mirthless laugh.
What a prize you might have had then, my son. If you'd managed to keep her.
Irene is the finest healer of her generation,
Kaol said with deadly quiet.
Her worth is greater than any crown.
And in this war, it might very well be. You don't need to bother proving my value to him, Irene said, her icy eyes pinned on his father. I know precisely how talented I am. I don't require his blessing. She meant every damn word. His father turned that aloof stare upon her again, curiosity filling it for a moment. If he'd been asked even minutes ago how he thought this encounter might go, Irene being utterly unfazed by his father, Irene going toe to toe with his father, would not have been among the possible outcomes. His father leaned back in his chair.
You didn't come here to at last fulfill your oath to me. Did you?
That promise is broken, and for that I apologize,
Kaol managed to say. Irene bristled. Before she could tell him not to bother again, Kaol went on.
We came to warn you.
His father lifted a brow.
Morath is on the move, this I know. I've taken the precaution of having your beloved mother and brother removed to the mountains.
Morath is on the move,
Kaol said, fighting the disappointment that he would see neither of the two people he needed to speak to the most.
And it is on its way directly here.
His father, for once, went still.
10,000 troops,
Kaol said.
They come to sack the city. He could have sworn his father paled.
You know this without a doubt.
I sailed with an army sent from the Khagan, a legion of his Rook riders amongst them. Their scouts discovered the information. The Rookan fly here as we speak, but their Dargon soldiers won't arrive for at least a week or longer.
He came forward, just one step.
You need to rally your forces. Prepare the city. Immediately. But his father swirled his wine, frowning at the red liquid within.
There are no forces here. None to make a dent in 10,000 men.
Then begin the evacuation, and move as many into the keep as you can. Prepare for a siege.
Last I looked, boy, I was still Lord of Aniel. You gladly turned your back on it. Twice.
You have Terran.
Terran's a scholar. Why do you think I sent him away with his mother like a nursing babe?
His father sneered.
Have you come back to bleed for Aniel, then? To bleed for this city at last?
Don't you talk to him like that, Irene said with dangerous calm.
His father ignored her. But Irene stepped up to Kaol's side once more.
I am the heir apparent to the healer on high of the Torre Chesme. I came at your son's behest, back to the lands of my birth, to help in this war, along with 200 healers from the Torre itself. Your son spent the last several months forging an alliance with the Khaganate, and now all of the Khaganate's armies sail to this continent to save your people. So while you sit here in your miserable keep, tossing insults at him, know that he has done what no other could do. And if your city survives, it will be because of him, not you.
His father blinked at her. Slowly. It took all of Kaol's restraint to keep from sweeping Irene into his arms and kissing her. But Kaol said to his father,
prepare for a siege and get the defenses ready, or the Silver Lake will run red again beneath the claws of Erewhon's beasts. I know the history of this city as well as you do.
Kaol debated ending it there, but he asked,
is that why you didn't kneel to Erewhon? Or to the puppet king before him?
His father said, picking at his food.
You knew that the old king was Volg-possessed? His father's fingers stilled on a crust of hearty bread, the only sign of his shock.
No. Only that he was building a host throughout the land that did not seem natural. I am no king's lackey, no matter what you may think of me.
He lowered his hand once more.
Of course, in my plans to get you out of harm's way, it seems it only led you closer to it.
Why bother?
I meant what I said in Rifthold. Terran is not a warrior, not at heart. I saw what was building in Morath, in the Farian Gap, and required my eldest son to be here to pick up the sword should I fall. And now you have returned. At the hour when the shadow of Morath has crept around us on all sides.
All sides but one,
Kaol said, motioning toward the white fangs just barely visible through the windows high above.
Rumor has it Erewhon has spent these months hunting down the wild men of the fangs. If you are so short of soldiers, call for aid.
His father's mouth tightened.
They are half-savage nomads who relish killing our people.
As ours have relished killing them, let Erewhon unite us.
And offer them what? The mountains have belonged to us since before Gavin Havilyard sat on his throne.
Irene muttered, offer them the damn moon if it will convince them to help. His father smirked.
Can you offer such a thing, as the heir apparent to the healer on high?
Careful,
Kaol growled. His father ignored that, too.
I would rather have my head on a pike
then give the wild men of the Fangs an inch of Aniel's land, let alone ask them for aid.
I hope your people agree, said Irene. His father let out one of those joyless laughs.
I like you better than the Assassin Queen, I think. Perhaps marrying the rabble will breed some backbone into our bloodline once more.
Kaol's blood roared in his ears, but Irene's lips curved into a smile. You're exactly as I pictured you to be, she said. His father only inclined his head.
Prepare this city, this keep,
Kaol managed to say through his gritted teeth,
or you'll deserve everything you bring down upon it.
Chapter 19. 15 minutes later, Kaol could feel Irene still trembling as they entered a small yet warm bedroom. One of the few cozy places in this horrible keep. A bed and a half-rusted washing basin filled most of the space, a ewer of steaming water beside it. Not exactly a bedroom fit for a lord's son. He fought the heat that warmed his cheeks.
I was disowned, remember,
Kaol said, leaning against the shut door, their packs discarded at his feet.
This bedroom is meant for a guest.
I'm sure your father had it selected just for you.
I'm sure he did.
Irene snarled. He's worse than you portrayed. Kaol gave her a tired, small smile.
And you were brilliant.
Utterly brilliant. His father, at least, had agreed to begin the evacuations for those on the outskirts of the city. And by the time they'd made their way to this room, the keep had already been abuzz with readying for a siege. If his father needed help planning it, the man hadn't let on. Tomorrow, after they rested tonight, he'd see for himself what his father had in mind. But for now, after almost 2 days of flying through the frigid air, he needed to rest. And his wife, however bold and fearless, needed to rest as well, whether she admitted it or not. So Kaol pushed off the door, prowling to where Irene paced in front of the bed.
I'm sorry for what he said to you.
She waved him off. I'm sorry you ever had to deal with him for longer than that conversation. Her temper, despite all that loomed, despite the bastard ruling over this city, warmed something in him. Enough so that Kaol closed the distance between them, halting her pacing by taking her hand. He brushed his thumb over her wedding band.
I wish you were meeting her instead. My mother,
he said softly. The fierceness in her eyes banked. I do too. Her mouth quirked to the side. Though I'm surprised your father cared enough to send them away at a whisper of a threat.
They're assets to him. I wouldn't be surprised if he sent them with a good part of the trove.
Irene glanced around in doubt.
Aniel is one of the richer territories in Otterlin, despite what this keep suggests.
He kissed her knuckles, her ring.
There are chambers full of treasure in the catacombs. Gold, jewels, armor. Rumor has it the wealth of an entire kingdom is down there.
Irene let out an impressed hum, but said, I should have told Sartak and Nezrin to bring more healers than the 50 we selected. Hafiza would remain with the foot soldiers and cavalry. But Arisha, her second in command, would fly with the Rooks and lead the group, Irene included.
We'll make do with what we have. I doubt there was a single magically gifted healer in this city until an hour ago.
Her throat bobbed. Can this keep survive a siege long enough for the terrestrial army to get here? It doesn't look like it can withstand another winter, let alone an army at its doorstep.
This keep has stood for well over 1,000 years. It survived Erewhon's second army, even when they sacked Aniel. It will outlast this third war of his, too.
Where will the people evacuate to? The mountains are already covered in snow.
There are passes through them. Dangerous, but they could make it to the wastes if they stay together and bring enough supplies.
Heading north of Aniel was a death trap, with the witches holding the Farian Gap, and going too far south would take them to Morath's doorstep. To go east would take them in the path of the army they sought to outrun.
They might be able to hide in Oakwald, along the edge of the Fangs.
He shook his head.
There are no good options. Not at this time of year.
A lot of them won't make it, she said softly.
They'll stand a better chance in the Fangs than here,
he said with equal quiet. They were still his people, had still shown him kindness, even when his own father had not.
I'll see to it that my father sends some of the soldiers who were too old to fight with them. They'll remember the way.
I know I'm nothing more than the rabble, Irene said, and Kaol snickered. But those who do choose to stay, who are led into the keep, perhaps while we wait for our own forces, I could help find room for them, supplies. See if there are any healers among them who might have access to the herbs and ingredients we need. Get bandages ready. He nodded, pride filling his chest to the point of pain. A lady, if not by blood, then by nobility of character. His wife was more of a lady than any other he'd met in any court. Then let us prepare for war, husband, Irene said, sorrow and dread filling her eyes. And it was the sight of that kernel of fear, not for herself, but what they were undoubtedly soon to take part in, to witness, that had him sweeping her into his arms and laying her upon the bed.
War can wait until morning,
he said, and lowered his mouth to hers. Dawn broke, and the rooks arrived. So many rooks they blotted out the watery sun, the boom of wings and rustle of feathers filling the skies. People cried out this time, their voices a herald of the screams to come when that army reached their doorstep. On the plain before the southern side of the keep, flowing to the lake edge itself, the rooks settled. It had long been kept clear of settlement, the flat expanse riddled with hot springs and prone to annual flooding, though a few stubborn farmers still tried to coax crops from the hard soil. It had once been part of the lake itself, before the western falls tucked into the Fangs had been dammed up, their roaring waters quieted to a trickle that fed the lake. For centuries, Kaol's ancestors had debated breaking the dam, letting that raging river run free once more, now that their ancient forges had given way to a few water-powered mills that could easily be moved elsewhere. Yet the destruction breaking that dam would cause, even if they gathered every water wielder in the realm to control the flow, would be catastrophic. The entire plain would flood in a matter of minutes, some of the city being swept away as well. The waters would barrel down from the mountains, destroying everything in their path in a mighty wave that would flow to Oakwald itself. The lowest levels of the keep, the gate that opened onto the plain, would be wholly submerged. So the dam had stayed, and the grassy plain with it. The rooks settled themselves in neat rows, and Kaol and Irene watched from the battlements, other sentries breaking from their posts to join them, as the riders began setting up camp with whatever supplies their mounts had carried. The healers would be brought up later, though a few might remain down in their camp until Morath's legion arrived. Two dark shapes soared overhead, and the sentries fell back to their posts as Nezrin and Sartak landed on the battlement wall, a small falcon alighting beside the former's rook. Falcon Inar, then. Nezrin leaped off her rook in an easy movement, her face grave as any pocket of Hellas's realm.
Morath is 3 days away, possibly four, she said breathlessly.
Sartak came up behind her, the rooks needing no hitching post.
We kept high overhead, out of sight, but Falcon was able to get closer.
The shifter remained in falcon form by Salki. Irene stepped forward.
What did you see?
Nezrin shook her head, her normally golden-brown skin bloodless.
Volgan men, mostly. But they all look fast. Vicious.
Kaol reined in his grimace.
No sign of the witches?
None,
Sartak said, running a hand over his braided hair.
though they might be waiting to sweep down from the Farian Gap when the army arrives here.
Let's pray they don't, Irene said, surveying the rooks in the valley below. 1,000 rooks. It had seemed like a gift from the gods, seemed like an impossibly large number. And yet seeing them assembled on the plain, even the mighty birds might be swept away in the tide of battle.
Chapter 20.
Do you know the story of the queen who walked through worlds?
Seated on the mossy carpet of an ancient glen, one hand toying with the small white flowers strewn across it, Aelin shook her head. In the towering oaks that formed a lattice over the clearing, small stars blinked and shimmered, as if they'd been snared by the branches themselves. Beyond them, bathing the forest with light bright enough to see by, a full moon had risen. All around them, faint lilting singing floated on the warm summer air.
It is a sad story, her aunt said,
one corner of her red-painted mouth curling upward, as she leaned back on her seat carved into a granite boulder. Her usual place, while they had these lessons. These long, peaceful chats deep into the balmy summer nights. And an old one. Aelin lifted an eyebrow. Aren't I a little old for fairy stories? She'd indeed just celebrated her 20th birthday 3 days ago, in another clearing not too far from here. Half of Dorinel had come, it had seemed, and yet her mate had found a way to sneak her from the revelry. All the way to a secluded pool in the forest's heart. Her face still warmed to think of that moonlit swim, what Rowan had made her feel, how he'd worshipped her in the sun-warmed water. Mate. The word was still a surprise, as it had been to arrive here at Spring's End and see him beside her aunt's throne and simply know. And in the month since, their courting, Aelin indeed blushed at the thought of it. What they'd done in that forest pool had been the culmination of those months, and an unleashing. The mating marks on her neck, and on Rowan's, proved it. She would not be returning to Terrasen alone when autumn arrived.
No one is too old for fairy stories, her aunt said, faint smile growing. And as you are part fairy yourself, I would think you would have some interest in them.
Aelin smiled back, bowing her head.
Fair enough, Aunt.
Aunt wasn't entirely accurate, not with generations and millennia separating them, but it was the only thing the queen had suggested Aelin call her. Maeve settled further into her seat.
Long ago, when the world was new, when there were no human kingdoms, when no wars had marred the earth, a young queen was born.
Aelin folded her legs beneath her, angling her head.
She did not know she was a queen. Amongst her people, power was not inherited, but simply born. And as she grew, her strength rose with her. She found the land she dwelled in to be too small for that power, too dark and cold and grim. She had gifts similar to many wielded by her kind, but she had been given more. Her power a sharper, more intricate weapon, enough that she was different. Her people saw that power and bowed to it, and she ruled them. Word spread of her gifts, and 3 kings came to seek her hand, to form an alliance between their throne and the one she had built for herself, small as it might have been. For a time, she thought it would be the newness, the challenge that she had always craved. The 3 kings were brothers, each mighty in his own right, their power vast and terrifying. She picked the eldest among them, not for any particular skill or grace, but for his countless libraries. What she might learn in his lands, what she might do with her power. It was that knowledge she craved, not the king himself. A strange story. Aelin's brows rose,
but her aunt continued on. So they were wed, and she left her small territory to join him in his castle. For a time, she was contented by both her husband and the knowledge his home offered her. He and his two brothers were conquerors and spent much of their time away leashing new lands to their shared throne. She did not mind, not when it gave her freedom to learn as she would. But her husband's libraries contained knowledge even he did not realize was held within. Lore and wisdom from worlds long since turned to dust. She learned that there were indeed other worlds. Not the dark, blasted realm in which they lived, but worlds beyond that, living atop one another and never realizing it. Worlds where the sun was not a watery trickle through the ash clouds, but a golden stream of warmth. Worlds where green existed. She had never heard of such a color, green. Nor had she heard of blue, not the shade of sky that was described. She could not so much as picture it. Aelin frowned. A pitiful existence. Maeve nodded grimly. It was. And the more she read about these other worlds, where long-dead wayfarers had once roamed, the more she wanted to see them. To know the kiss of the sun on her face, to hear the morning songs of sparrows, the crying of gulls over the sea. The sea, that too was foreign to her. An endless sprawl of water with its own moods and hidden depths. All they had in her lands were shallow, murky lakes and half-dried streams. So while her husband and his two brothers were off waging yet another war, she began to ponder how she might find a way into one of those worlds. How she might leave. Is such a thing even possible? Something nagged at her, as if it might indeed be true. But perhaps that was one of her own mother's tales, or even Marion's, tugging on her memory. Maeve nodded. It was. Using the very language of existence itself, doors might be opened, however briefly,